Now today we're returning to the book of Ruth and to what is the climax of the story. We began with the hopelessly bitter circumstance of Naomi in chapter 1, whose husband and two sons have died in Moab. And this story has continued to unfold as Naomi's daughter-in-law Ruth, of whom the book is named, demonstrates a surprising devotion to her mother-in-law. Right, in a world, right, if the world is merely a place where others get what they deserve and you are working to get what you deserve, right, the world can become a place and is viewed by many as merely a place where one doesn't get mad, they get even. However, right, we learn that the world is not merely like that. This surprising devotion of Naomi, of Ruth to her mother-in-law Naomi, and the kindness of the Lord's providences that we read about in chapter 2 show us that there is something that is greater and more beautiful at work in the world. And as we look at this morning's passage, we're going to be looking at the search for rest, the work of rest, and the hope of rest. And before I read this morning's passage, Michael's going to come forward, and he's going to prepare us by playing his piano piece that's actually based on Ruth chapter 3. Could I do that?
Yes.
Heavenly Father, we want to say we are listening. Lord, send your Spirit to sow into our hearts the good news of your word, and tend it, Lord, and cause it to grow, that it might bear fruit to bring glory to Jesus, in whose name we ask these things. Amen.
A couple of weeks ago, I shared some background to hopefully help you engage how an instrumental piece could connect to Scripture. And talked about the chiastic structure, how the outsides match and the next steps in match all the way sort of concentrically to the middle. And you can see that structure of the song by the letters that are marked out on the left-hand side. I also wanted to highlight a couple of parts, since we are looking at chapter 3 today, in which this is based on. In some translations, the opening line of chapter 3 is, "My daughter, it is time." And so that's why we have this chime. "My daughter, it is time." And so it chimes there. As it closes, Boaz tells Ruth, "Stay here tonight and in the morning." So again, we have that idea of time, and that's how it closes. Again, a slightly different chord underneath because there's more hope, but the chime nonetheless. Another example of how the text influences the music. In the B section there, Ruth is heading to the threshing floor, and we have this ascending progression. Right, there's a lot of hope in that. She heads that way. The corresponding section down there with B prime or whatever that might be, he says, "Don't worry about a thing." Right? He's going to attend to the matter, and that's the hope appears again. But this time, as it ends, this line connects to this. This minor chord is a little jarring. He says, "There is another who is closer than I." Oh. "But wait here. In the morning, I'll go and talk with him." So those are a couple of examples there. So if you'd like to follow in the text, or if you're particularly attached to timekeeping, you can tell me how close I am to the recording numbers. But anyhow, maybe this is another step to engaging.
Thank you, Michael. Okay. Ruth chapter 3, verses 1 to 18. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say, I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize her. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." And so she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. And then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" And then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." This is God's word. Okay, so let's look at the search for rest. Here at the beginning of chapter 3, Naomi takes up a mission. The mission, she says, is to seek rest for you that it may be well with you. That is, that Naomi wants to secure Ruth's marriage so that Ruth will be taken care of and not live anxiously for either Naomi, for whom she's working to help try and provide for, but for her own future. And in chapter 2, we read about this man of means, right, this landowner, and his kindness to Ruth and the special attention and care that he has given and shown Ruth. And when Naomi learns that it's Boaz, who is a close relative and a potential redeemer, one who could help them, an advocate for them, and that Boaz has shown particular interest in Ruth herself, Boaz becomes the likely candidate for such a marriage. Boaz embodies all of the virtues which every culture, I think, on earth understands as to what it means to be a good man. And that's over and against what maybe our culture would say would be to be a real man. There's a difference. To be a good man, right, like I said, in every culture would be to provide, to protect, and for the sake of the alliteration, to procreate. But that is to father, right? To raise up, to nurture those who are younger. Boaz has already demonstrated that he has 2 of those qualities, doesn't he? 2 of these capabilities in protecting, because he has advocated and defended her, but then also in providing, and that he has given to them the material means of food. Naomi instructs Ruth what she needs to do next. Ruth is to wash and to anoint herself and to go down to the threshing floor secretly. After the man has finished eating and drinking, she is to observe where he lies and to go uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. Now that is pretty bold. A case could be made, and some commentators make a case that it's maybe brazen. It's maybe even dangerous, right? This is a hard-working season, right? There's been hard work outside, and there is hard play afterwards. Boaz has already thought it necessary to instruct the men who are working with him or for him to not touch her, but to leave her alone and to not rebuke or reproach her as she gathers and gleans among the harvesters. And so, though Naomi is seeking a good thing for Ruth, it's not a thing that she has asked her to do that is without risk. And the question maybe for you is, what would you risk for yourself, for those you love, if what you were risking for was something called rest? Right? That's what she's seeking. Naomi is seeking for Ruth. And the word that's used for rest here is not the word Sabbath, which most of us are familiar, but it's more a word that means quiet, or to be still, or to be settled. It is, in fact, the sitting down after a great effort and knowing that you're finished with it. You all, maybe you're experiencing some of that right now. In preparation for Christmas Eve and for Christmas Day, there's been a lot of activity. There continues to be a lot of activity, a lot of work and energy that's expended so that there'll be time around the table or around a living room in which you are all gathered together that you might experience a sense of abiding stillness, right? Everybody is settled. I don't know if you're, the image that I always imagine in this is in the movie While You Were Sleeping with Sandra Bullock, and she's been invited over to a house where they're celebrating Christmas, and she's seated on a fireplace mantle, and she's just scanning the room as people are talking and responding. And she, who doesn't have any family, you know, she experiences, I think, this sense of rest, what this means. As she's drinking it in, right? That's what we really want to be the culmination of all of this effort, is the sense of abiding, of rest. And a place of abiding and rest is just what a widowed immigrant from Moab desires. It's just what Ruth wants. It's just what her mother-in-law wants and wants for her. And if we're honest, it's what we want. Right? It's what it is that we're all searching for, a place where we can be still and know that we belong. Now, how does the rest come to us? How does that rest come to us? What brings us to that place of stillness? Let's look at this work of rest. And we're going to start by looking at this thing that Naomi asks Ruth to do. Now, it's odd and it's unexpected. And we might be curious about it, but we also might ignore it because we don't seem to understand what she's saying or what she's doing. Its significance might be lost to us and we'll just kind of blow past it. What does Naomi tell Ruth to do before she lies next to Boaz or lies at his feet? To uncover his feet. What's that about? I mean, is that like strategic and tactical? Is the thought that this is a way to awaken Boaz without actually wakening Boaz, right? He's going to, at some point, his feet are going to be cold in the middle of the night, and he's going to be like, what's going on, you know? And he'll wake up, and then he'll notice her. Is that really all that's going on there? I want us to stop, right, and pause and to look at that more closely. Unshod feet is going to come up again in Ruth. Okay, so that's the first thing. We need to pay attention to that. And if you've read the Bible, you know that there are other places where a person's feet are unsandaled and they are asked to go barefoot. Do you remember where those passages are, where those instances are? The first is in Exodus 3, when the Lord speaks to Moses outside, out of the burning bush, and says, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. The second is in Joshua 5, where an instance just like that seems to happen, where Joshua has come in to spy out the land just before the battle of Jericho, and he meets a great warrior. And it is the commander of the armies of the Lord. It's the Lord's, the host, the captain of the host. And he says to Joshua, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. That's great, Randy. Those two seem to be related. How does that relate to this? What do those two stories have to do with the book of Ruth? I'm not going to tell you today. but I do want you to note it. This is what I want you to recognize right now. Firstly, we live in a world of pairs. Right? There is a pair in that those two stories with Exodus, with Moses, and with Joshua. And the pair is the Creator and His creature. The other pair is the Holy God and a holy place. Right? The image of God, of which we all share, is a pair. Right? God created man and woman in His own image. In the image of God, He created him, male and female, He created them. Two. We see it over and over again. In creation, there are twos that are inextricably related. You shouldn't and you can't separate them. There are pairs of eyes, pairs of ears, pairs of hands, pairs of legs, pairs of feet, pairs of pants. I hope none of you gets a pant for Christmas. It's a pair of pants, a pair of sandals. Right, that there are twos that go together is important. It's important for us to recognize this. Right, in another way, right, this pair of bare feet exhibits something about the nature of that pair. Some pairs are holy. They are special. And among those two pairs is vulnerability. To be paired and naked in the context of a relationship is the most intimate of relationships and the most intimate of moments. For a creature to be in the presence of their creator is another one of those holy moments. Right? How might you express the holiness of a place, a moment of a relationship? Well, it seems to be that bare feet seems to go nicely. Now, when you read the two passages from Exodus and Joshua, right, being asked to remove your sandals because the place you are standing is holy ground seems to be something that is so self-evident in the scriptures that it doesn't need explaining. Right, this practice, it carried forward millennia. And Jewish tradition tells us that the priest who served in the temple did so with bare feet. Being barefooted says something about humility. How poor do you have to be to sell the shoes off your feet? But it also says something about vulnerability. It says something about the necessary pairs and what those necessary pairs beget. Right? And this has spiritual significance for us too. Is faith merely saying that you believe in God? No. True faith is accompanied by works, isn't it? You say you believe, James says, and I will show you what I believe by what I do. Consequently, to enjoy the presence of God requires a wholehearted, naked devotion to God. Blessed are the pure in heart, Jesus said, because they will see God. The privilege of the benefit of relational nakedness has to be accompanied by the obligation of personal devotion. That's a pair. They go together. Now, the significance of Ruth uncovering Boaz's feet is unexplained to us. And I am speculating, not I don't think weakly, but I am, it doesn't tell us exactly what's going on. Nobody does this today. I'm confident in my application, though. What I'm saying is true. You have to be, to enter into a relationship with God, the pureness of heart, right, the singular devotion. The relational nakedness and the giving over of who you are to him is something that is required. It's not just mental agreement that you believe it. But though we may not recognize, you know, immediately the significance of Ruth's action, their significance, though, here is not lost on Boaz. Okay, Boaz seems to understand what we maybe don't readily recognize. At midnight, we read that he was startled and he turned over and behold, a woman lay at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, that you have not gone after the young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do all that you ask." Boaz is answering yes to her asking for rest. And notice that Boaz imagines himself, he sees himself as blessed as well, right? He is given rest in that someone has sought rest in him. The desire to rest in another's strength and the desire to be strong enough for another to rest in your strength runs as deep as what it means to be a man and a woman. And so here on the threshing floor, Ruth and Boaz find hope of rest. But there's one question that remains to be answered. Intimacy and its obligations shouldn't be impulsive. They shouldn't be presumptive. They're ordered and purposeful. And doing the right thing means doing it rightly. Right? We learn that there's a man who is a closer relative than Boaz and thus falls earlier in line to be a redeemer. And this has to be worked out before Ruth and Boaz may step forward. And Boaz, it actually highlights more Boaz's goodness and his desire to do rightly by his saying that this thing has to be done first. But think about it. He's lying here there on the threshing floor at night with a woman who has offered himself to him. What sort of man would not take advantage of that sort of a situation? Well, I'll tell you who wouldn't. A good man. A good man wouldn't. Right? The work that brings about the deep soul rest for which we yearn is found in the pair of community and intimacy and obligation with your Redeemer. The word of rest is the work, or the work of rest is the work of finding your rest in the Lord. That's the work, right? For Him to be your Redeemer. So Boaz and Ruth, they lay in wait until the early morning. And their waiting now, though, is not a waiting in wondering what might happen or what else could happen or what it could mean. Instead, it is a waiting in hope. And the hope of rest is certain. It's only a hope that awaits fulfilling. Ruth will be at rest. And so we come, right, to this hope of rest. This good man, Boaz, who seems to have always been a good man and that he has defended and guarded Ruth's honor and reputation. And he does so now. He says, "Let it not be known that the woman has come to the threshing floor." And when Ruth arrives back where Naomi is staying, her mother-in-law is anxious to hear how it's gone, how it's played out. No, Ruth has to say, "We didn't get married immediately. Yes, he did look on me favorably. But he said there was a kinsman redeemer who was closer, who has priority in the redemption. And Boaz is going to see if he's willing to redeem the land of Elimelech. And if he will, then good. But if he doesn't, Boaz has said he will redeem." Things are good. The question of Ruth's rest is settled one way or another. But there is one who still remains restless. And who is that? It's Naomi. You know, I think a good case could be made that the book of Ruth is really about Naomi. Naomi is the character who is most deeply troubled at the beginning of the story. She is the most changed over the course of the book. She's seeking rest for Ruth, but she still counts herself, as she says in chapter 2, as among those who are the dead, or as good as dead. Right? When she receives the grain and learns of Boaz's kindness, what changes in her? And what does that have to say about her rest? And we read that Boaz sent Ruth home with 6 measures of grain. Now, it's such a large amount that Boaz has to put it on her, right? So it's not 6 measures, like 6 little, like an egg tray kind of a thing. It must have been a lot. Boaz has to put it on her. And setting down the grain and continuing to tell the story, Ruth relates this. She says, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" It's a kind gesture, isn't it? It's compassionate. It's thoughtful of Boaz that he has both Ruth and Naomi and their needs in mind. And it could be understood as simply as that, right? Here's some food for your trouble. But notice Naomi's response. She doesn't say, "Bless him," right? "There's going to be food tonight." She doesn't say that. She seems to ignore it altogether. She doesn't express a word of thanks to the Lord who has provided. She jumps right to saying this: "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until the matter settled today." But the day that began in chapter 3 as Naomi purposes to seek rest for Ruth ends the next morning with Boaz pledging not to rest until the matter is settled. The grain was for their needs. They needed food. Boaz was providing that. But the six was for Naomi. Boaz was giving more than just grain to Ruth. He was making a pledge to Naomi. Boaz, right, he must know that Ruth, or that Naomi, has been matchmaking. Behind the scenes, right? It's an unmistakable proposal, aside from the significance, right, of the bare feet being lost on us sometimes. It's an unmistakable proposal of marriage. It's humbly bold. And Boaz answers in kind. Granted, Ruth doesn't come home to Naomi with a husband, but with 6 measures of grain, because it would not be right for Ruth to return empty-handed. Right? What passes in this interaction between Boaz and Naomi is beautifully clever and winsome. So much is being said in an act. Both are saying, "I see what you're saying." To understand what Boaz is saying to Naomi, you have to first remember, how many days are there in the biblical work week? 7th? 6 measures were given so that Ruth wouldn't return empty-handed. What is Boaz saying? He is pledging a promise to Naomi. If Boaz sends Ruth home with a works week, a works week measure of grain, what do you think is going to be in Ruth's hands on the 7th day? The rest. Boaz will not rest until he sees Naomi's work finished and Ruth at rest. Right, we've come to the 4th Sunday here of Advent. Christmas Eve, right? We're entering into a beautiful story in which the church's bridegroom will not rest until he sees God's people reconciled to their God. Our Redeemer will not rest until the matter is settled. And the news of that settling is not announced by the shouts of great men coming back from accomplishing great deeds, but in the cries of a child in the town of Bethlehem. The Lord has visited his people and given them bread, and the bread that he gives to us is the bread of life, come down from heaven, that those who eat of that bread may live. Jesus Christ has given us rest, has given us himself.